Et Naim, Nikki Yasam Hilo, Nikki Machuptamaidu. Hello, everyone. My name is Hilo, and I'm Machuptamaidu. We acknowledge and are mindful that Chico State stands on lands that were originally occupied by the first people of this area, the Machupta, and we recognize their distinctive spiritual relationship with this land and the waters that run through campus. We are humbled that our campus resides upon sacred lands that have sustained the Machupta people for centuries and continue to do so today.
All right, listeners, welcome back to another episode of First Generation, One of Many. Again, if you listened to the last episode, you became privy to or learned that moving forward for the time being, I am without Teresa. It is still a challenge to not have her here. I was talking with the guests today a little before the show about having only one person makes some things smoother and easier in scheduling or talking sometimes, but not having Teresa here takes away a lot more of benefit and greatness. So I still miss her, and hopefully in the future, sooner than later, things will work back out to have her here again. So again, if you haven't listened before, our mission on the podcast is to create an archive of discussions with and about first-generation student experiences in and out of the classroom. We hope to continue raising awareness and understanding, provide voice for students and alum, as well as present resources for faculty, staff, and students working for and collaborating with first-generation students. Today, I am excited, as most episodes. This one is excitement more for working and getting to have two guests who I've seen enough over the last few years and been able to do a number of different projects, especially in the classroom with inquiry and how to use library resources and also archiving and keeping things going so people can look back someday if things exist 100 years from now, they can run into something that we've archived. So the two guests today are from the library. They are librarians, and we're going to get to their information soon and hear a lot and learn a lot about what they're doing. So to lead into that, here are two great quotes about our topic today. The first one is from Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, essayist, and poet. She says, "I am of a fearsome mind to throw my arms around every living librarian who crosses my path, on behalf of the souls they never knew they saved. I love it. As a frequent visitor of libraries throughout the years, I probably never got to say thank you to many librarians who would just answer my question, give me a Dewey Decimal number, and send me on my way, and then I would leave satisfied with whatever I was looking for. Or someone says, hey, it's over there. Either way. But I love that quote, and I know librarians maybe appreciate it, but as one of my guests said earlier, well, we try to keep our hands to ourselves sometimes, but hey, if it's Barbara Kingsolver coming in for a hug, I'll take it." So that's great. And the next one is from R. David Lanks. He's the Virginia and Charles Bowden Professor of Librarianship at the University of Texas's School of Information. He says, "To be a librarian is not to be neutral or passive or waiting for a question. It is to be a radical positive change agent within our community." And I think the two guests today, from what I've seen, are doing this actively. And it is another great sentiment about the heart of a true librarian. All right. So let's get right to our guests. First, we have Stephanie Baldivia. Stephanie is an archivist in the Special Collections and University Archives Department and a lecturer librarian at Chico State. She is in the practice of reference, instruction, and outreach activities. Stephanie's research interests include Latinx leadership in libraries, critical race theory approaches to archival work, teaching with primary sources, and diversifying collections through oral histories. She identifies as Chicana and Latinx and is a first-generation scholar. Her undergraduate degree was awarded in 2010 from Humboldt State University in Native American Studies, and she received her Master's of Library Studies in 2016 from San Jose State University. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, everyone. So glad to be here. Hi, Joshua.
Yeah, wow. You are a lot on this page, but we didn't even, we'll add this in. You are a lumberjack, a Spartan, and a wildcat on top of everything else.
Indeed.
So great to have you here finally. You can stay unmuted because the more reactions we get, the better the podcast is. So it's more fun to hear laughter.
Oh, dear.
But Stephanie knows it's been a long time coming for me in the podcast because I know I talked to her about it in different ways and approached her for some input 2 or 3 years before I actually got to launch a podcast. So it's great to have you here finally. It's been wonderful. You and I have done work with podcasting archives, right? And so, or maybe I should reverse that, archiving podcasts.
Yes.
A little Willy Wonka there, I guess. But so archiving podcasts in that one of the courses I teach, students have been creating podcasts for about the past 6 or so years, maybe even more than that now. And hooking up with Stephanie, we're able to archive most of them as the students agreed to have it archived. And so that's been great. I think we missed last year during COVID. We have some podcasts. So I do have some that I need to get work done to get them archived though. Yes. So that's wonderful. Now, our next guest works closely with Stephanie as well. And it is William Cuthbertson. William is instruction coordinator and undergraduate engagement librarian at Chico State. He develops courses in undergraduate research skills for first year and first generation students. He is Merriam Library's liaison to the undergraduate education and to departments of political science, criminal justice, sociology, social work, and geography and planning. William's academic work focuses on increasing students' investment in their academic success. Welcome, William.
Hi.
Yes.
Hello. I went to Indiana University. I want to get that in there.
Throw it in. So we have, let's just cover that. We have a Hoosier, we have a lumberjack, Spartan, wildcat, and then I'll throw myself in as a wildcat Aggie. From UC
Davis.
Oh, Davis. I thought it was Texas A&M. Okay.
Cool. They're Aggies also, yes.
Yeah.
But yeah. So it's great having you here too. I know you and I haven't been able to do as much or cross paths as much, but in your first couple of years, we were able to do quite a bit with EOP students and a lot of the inquiry and making sure they understood how to really invest their time and utilize certain resources to capitalize on being a college student in their first year. So it's great to see you again.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having us.
I think right before we started, the revelation of us in a Zoom meeting, which makes recording podcasts much smoother to do it through Zoom, but it also made us laugh a little because we are all in the same building while we're recording this episode.
Stephanie's two doors over.
I think Stephanie and William are like, only one room removed from each other. And I'm only 3 floors removed.
I'm actually on the 3rd floor right now.
Oh, you went to your, okay.
I have a dual role.
Perfect.
Member of the University Archives staff and also a member of the RIO Reference Instruction and Outreach staff. I have 2 offices.
Ah, okay. And I was going to say, that looks like your archive office from my memories.
There's many boxes in here right now,
yes. Yeah, hey, that's the way it goes. So we just needed to invite one more person from the 2nd floor, and then we could just have someone on every floor of the library for this.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Let's get down to some of what listeners really can benefit from. So before we jump into hearing about your specific journeys through education and what you're doing as first generation and for first generation, let's talk a little bit, if you can share a little bit about some of the library services or resources, and then who utilizes resources. That's kind of, you know, maybe a simple type of question, but there's probably more than just students, right? So there's that. And then how can people access your services? So it looks like William's going to jump in.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody does come to the library. I think that's kind of the joy of the work, actually, is that I think we like to think of ourselves as providing like a hub for intellectual activity on campus. But everybody comes here. So we do, obviously, the reference things that I think a lot of people associate with librarianship, the person at the desk who waits to answer a question or, you know, patiently or impatiently waits to be of use to the community. We do a ton of outreach. So not only to like the stuff that Stephanie does, she does a tremendous amount of outreach to student populations and student groups around campus. We're huge on student support services. We're huge on student success. And we have a really strong and growing instruction presence in the classroom, which is what I think we're all really about. So there's this idea of like the librarian just kind of sitting there waiting to be useful. But I think the career itself is so varied, and we're really student forward. We're really so much interested in seeing students make this place theirs rather than ours. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the only thing I might add is that in the library, we have a variety of resources, right? So I work, like I said, on the third floor in the university archives as well. And we do have quite a bit of outward facing community engagement that we do. So researchers that are interested in accessing primary sources related to Northeastern California and the 12 counties of our service region do connect with us to access, you know, maps, photographs, journals, diaries, and our manuscripts collection to do deep research about, you know, the primary industries of those 12 counties, the native communities of those 12 counties, and, you know, the environment and the way that people interact with the land historically. So, you know, resource extraction research or agriculture research. And so, you know, we do interface with both scholars and community members who are doing, you know, genealogical research or even, you know, research about, again, you know, those primary industries, that resource extraction. So yeah, we do have, you know, we serve a variety, a wide breadth of users, but we try to be student-centered in our approach to outreach. And anybody who wants to seek out primary sources that is off campus, they know we are here, right? So we do engage with folks, you know, when they come, but we don't, you know, we do try to participate in, you know, outward reaching archival stuff. So we have, in fact, October is Archives Awareness Month. And so, you know, statewide California institutions are really advocating for, you know, elevating archival awareness amongst community members and amongst scholars. So yeah, that's one thing that I really try not to lose hold of, is that, you know, understanding research, understanding information literacy is, you know, it's a hierarchical sort of scaffolded thing, right? You have primary sources, you have secondary sources, and you have tertiary sources, and getting people connected with each of those different models is important to my personal mission. And so, yeah, that's really the short of it.
Well, see, I was muted and I was just talking away. I'll have to go back and edit that part of the podcast for sure. But at least I'll have a blank spot where it was quiet to see. I was saying, it's always fun for me to listen to librarians and library speak, because I learn so much each conversation. Librarians have so much to share, knowledge, information. You know, if you could actually remember all the things you've looked up, imagine what that would be like for your brain. There's probably some librarians, right, with photographic memory who just have that, but in general, you look up so many things to help people that it's amazing. And then you only get to probably learn about a small amount of what you really would like to be learning about. Once you find something, someone introduces you to a topic, you're like, wow, didn't even know that topic existed. I want to learn more about it. You don't have time for it though, because you're finding so many fun topics and interesting areas, I would imagine.
So. Yeah, it's a great job. I don't drink and I don't smoke, but I definitely get high off of helping people. So it's one of those great service related professions.
Nice. All right. And so that is, let's see, because one thing for me in this new role, I'm working as the in technology area, and we have this Wildcat Computing Support Service now. And so one of our areas is having a desk in the library. And I've been fascinated over the last 6-7 weeks of just how many people come into the library who don't go to school here, who want to get things. I think I meet at least one or two a week who are just, hey, I happen to be coming in. I don't go to school here, but I know I can come check something out, or I can look into finding a way to get to something. And so I don't know how they do it. So I always have to say, hey, you can go talk to the librarians right down over there. But it's really wonderful to see how many people are utilizing it as a community resource too.
Great. I used to be a government information librarian before I got into the instructional aspect of it. And you would get some really interesting public patrons, right? So I had an individual, and this was in Chicago, who came to the library and he wanted to start his own government. And so he was asking, well, what materials do I need to start my own government? Which is a great conversation to have with a complete stranger about, like, I don't know, I think you need land. I think you're going to need to claim some space first. I think you're going to need to maybe petition the United States. I don't know, it's fascinating. So yeah, you get a lot of fun folks coming into the library. It's pretty cool.
I will also, this is something that we have been talking about within the Rio department. We have recently moved the librarian reference desk from the second floor computer lab to what we are now branding the Research Commons on the first floor, directly across from the circulation desk. And so to hear that people are still kind of habituated in trying to get research help from the TLP desk at the second floor is not surprising to me, but we are definitely trying to promote the fact that we have moved librarian offices down to the first floor Research Commons area. So yes, please send any questions for librarians down to that desk. Yep, we are ready and waiting.
We figured it's going to be a long process, and you know, it could be a few years before people even get the overall message, because there's people who aren't coming to campus for the next year. So they're going to show up next year and be like, oh, that's where the librarians were. So, and I love it, because I have to say, I also miss having you there, because for the first 2 or 3 weeks, we shared the desk space on the second floor as the carpets were getting fixed in the Research Common area. But all of a sudden I showed up the fourth week of school and there was no librarian at the desk. And it's like, oh, I miss hanging out, talking and learning about the library and learning about other things. And so I've had to venture down now and then to at least chat and go to the library's, you know, desk down where the librarians are. But it was nice to hang out there. I said, maybe we should figure out a way to have a shared time every now and then. But hanging out with librarians is fun for me. So that kind of gets us overall gist of library. So people are, you know, who weren't aware of library, because there is. When you ask, it was someone else was on, we were talking recently, and they were saying that they took a poll and asked their students in all the classes they're teaching, how many of them have been to the library? And these are third and fourth year students. And you can take a whole year out, of course, there was nothing, nobody could go in, but they were here for 2 years on campus. And he said on average of about 20 to 35 people in his class, 3 to 4 people were raising their hand saying they've been inside the library.
Wow.
So
that is harsh. Yeah, that is harsh to hear.
Thanks for having us, Josh.
Some of it is sort is like the disappointing downside of, like, people aren't coming into the library itself, but it also highlights then the amazing efforts of making things accessible without having to go to the library, because we know that's needed for some people. That's just the only way they're going to get to resources. They're not going to make it to a library for whatever the reason is. But how can we get people back in the library more would be a fun venture, I think. And maybe we will someday, people will start to come in, but I know for me, I like grabbing the physical book and holding it and the smell of it. And whether it's 140 years old or it's 2 weeks old or whatever, there's different smells that the books have and different feels. And so, and I'm still walking around with books, but
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You make a really good point. We have got some really cool tools on the library homepage, which I often tell people you just bookmark it because then you'll never forget where it is. It's library.csutico.edu. And we do have 24/7 chat. So if you're up at 3 a.m. and you're studying really hard and you need support, you can reach out to somebody and somebody will be there. A librarian will be there to help you. And we do, we have email, we have all kinds of ways from the library homepage that people can access services. You can't check out a book at 3 a.m., but you can sure find an article on the OneSearch homepage. So that's true, Josh. We don't always need to physically be in the building to help people.
I think too, for me, this brings up a lot of why I think Stephanie and I are here, because so much of whether or not folks feel comfortable going into the library, I think is really important to both our work, right? That's what we're really centered on, is making sure that folks don't feel intimidated by an academic space, or that we make sure that they know about all the things that they can do here and borrow here and take here for free. So they do get to kind of claim some territory for themselves. Because we hear a lot of language about people wanting to rent something. No one says, can I check this out? They say, can I rent this? We're going to ask them for money. And it always kind of breaks my heart a little bit, right? Because we don't ever charge people for stuff. And just the vocabulary is so capitalistic, I don't know.
Yes. Unfortunately, who knows? I think K through 12 libraries have become a certain thing for students and a certain experience of the way they're used in that, setting nowadays. Unfortunately, it's become very different. And as students are moving through, they seem to go to the library less in their educational experiences there. And even my kids, by about fourth grade, the library became even less of something that they were doing. And so there's that personal experience they have, unfortunately. So maybe what's,
I think it's part of the culture too. People just generally read less than they used to, or it's a lot of phone reading versus time of the book or time with an article, right? So that's one of the things we teach a lot of, is how to read an article in a fast, effective way. Because we get it, right? We get that it's not just students, and I hate to make it seem like it's generational, because it's everybody, right? People read less as a whole, and that's kind of the reality that impacts our work, right? So again, it's so important to get folks in here and make them feel at home.
Right. So if you're listening, go ahead and stop listening now and just go straight to the transcript so you can go read the transcript and work on some reading time for yourself.
Yes. Perfect.
But yeah, those are all good points. And just, of course, the advent of technology, electronic technology, how that is moving so quickly for people and the access to it and all those things, you can, because some of it is, I know for me, I used a program during my doctorate program for those years where I would read stuff, but I also would be driving quite a bit. And so I'd have to pull up the article and then have that program read the article to me while I was driving around. So it was nice. And I was like, oh, I can speed that up to read 400 words per minute. I made up a number. I'm not sure it was that fast, but I could read it. I could have it read faster than what I could read to myself, but it was still slow enough to comprehend and take notes. And even if I was sitting at a desk, I could press pause and I could highlight and I could note inside of the program, but having it read at a quicker rate was nicer than what the way my brain would read and go through and actually often read, word by word instead of, so it was, there's different features and things that people are having access to now that they're benefiting from, but hey, it's how we evolve as people here. So let's get to you two and evolution. Speaking of, we'd love to hear a little bit, because you both identify as first generation, a little bit about your journey through higher education. We've already played with our mascot names and heard about that, but what was the, because you can give things labels and names, but it's the experience that people want to hear about, and it's the experience that brings meaning in life to it. So,
right. I love that. Yeah. So when I decided to be a librarian, it was for a variety of reasons. You know, it was like an evolution. Like you said, my only friend in third grade was the school librarian. You know, she would hang out with me. She was really salty, a little bit of a stereotype bun head. You know, she was not friendly per se, but she got me and she was cool. So, you know, we hung out at, you know, at lunchtime and during breaks in elementary school. And then I met a woman in my undergraduate program who was a circus performer. She was a clown and she would do acrobatics. And she said, she was really a very talented physical comedian. And she told me, I'm dropping out of the clown of the circus to go to library school. And that was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard of. And after that, I started working at a library as like a student worker processing physically the books, like so putting stickers and labels and, you know, book sheet, you know, the date due slips inside of the books and stamping them for the college I was at. And then I tried out every single different department of the library. So I thought, I had a guidance counselor in high school who said, try it, you might hate it. And he was right. There are certain departments that I, you know, because of the work, was not that compelled to follow or fall into, you know, it wasn't as engaging for me. But when I found the university archives and the special collections, because I worked in like 5 different departments at my undergraduate library at HSU, and they were so mindful in their approach to how to bring a newcomer into the work. And so, you know, that's actually one of the Society of American Archivists' core values, is to reach out and do engagement with newer professionals and bring them in. And so I got a chance to go to a couple of conferences in the Bay Area as an undergraduate and really like found a lot of inspiration in the work that I saw could happen, right? I got to see women who are survivors of domestic violence do spoken word as oral history. I got to see the first archivist circle present their approach to Native American archival materials to the Society of American Archivists and feel the heat of the intensity in that room.
Wow.
And I was just in love. And so, you know, it became a real passion to just find a way to integrate alternative perspectives into institutional knowledge. And that's what has driven me in my work.
That's amazing. I love that you said that. And it gave me chills and that you're not alone in this venture. And I say it because about within the last 2 or 3 days, I was over in the staff lounge in the library area, and there was a student in there. And that's mainly who I see in this area, is mainly students. We have a lot of students who work in the library. And I was in there and I said, oh, hi, I'm Josh. Nice to meet you. And we started talking about, I said, oh, what got you to work in the library stuff? And she basically said the same story. She said, you know, one of my main friends in elementary school was the librarian, because they got me and I wanted to hang out in the library and learn about books and reading, and my friends and people my age didn't get that, but the librarian got me. So it was like, you know, you're not alone, and there's plenty of people with a similar experience of why they want to become librarians. So thanks for sharing a little bit about your journey. William, what can you share about your journey?
Yeah, gosh, it feels like a lot different, because I grew up in a military family, right? So my father's in the military. My mom was she had a 2-year nursing degree. So she did a lot of night college to get that degree. And then my dad got like his associates to get a better rank in the military, right? So that was his goal with that. And what was Well, gosh, what was weird about it is like growing up as like those latchkey kids of the 80s, right? So we would go home, nobody's there, you got something in the microwave and that was it, right? And so it was a lot of, I don't know, like not knowing how things worked, right? So when I got to college, it was horrible. I went to a large state school for a quarter. This is back when we had a quarter system, right? And I failed out my first quarter. I took a botany class. I wanted to be a botanist. And I didn't realize that you had to take a lab at the same time you took the science class. I thought they were all in one. And I was like, why am I doing so horribly in this class? And so I completely like failed the science class that I thought was going to be my major. And the one thing I always used to do is just read a lot, right? Because my dad, who was a bit of a drunk, used to say, you know, whenever we were just sitting around doing nothing, he's like, go read a book. Go be useful. Go read a book. So I'm like, okay, dude, I'll go read a book. So I read a lot of books. I failed out of that college and I transferred to a much smaller school. It was just a lot better for like individualized attention, right? And I think it was there that I really felt more at home. I felt like I belonged. And even so, right, like I was always good at making friends because we moved around a lot. So it was easy to make relationships with people, but it was harder to feel like I really belonged in a place. And to me, that kind of is the funnel that led to like this career now, right? Because I mentioned I started out in GovDocs. And so if you're like, I grew up with my dad having like aerial maps and topos all around the house because that was his, he was a radar installation specialist in the Air Force. And so when you're comfortable with that stuff and you realize other people aren't, you're like, oh shit, well, I can like help people get this stuff, right? And it was really useful. So I got into GovDocs that way and really loved it. And then you realize how much information there is out there that people could really benefit from understanding. So for me, it started off with the government and then it moved into like realizing that students were having the same problems in college now that I had, like with citations, for example, which is such a, seems like such a simple thing, right? Like you just follow a formula to write a citation. But I remember getting papers back from my instructors just like blood red with errors, right? For all these stupid mistakes that I had no idea how to fix. Like I didn't know what the format was. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I didn't know where to go to get the correct format. There was never a conversation about that. And I always kind of resented that. And talking to students now, I think they feel the same way, right? Like there's that sense of like, this is not supposed to be super complicated. It's supposed to be just a measure of acknowledgement, but we've turned it into this huge pressure-filled idea of perfection of what it means to write as an academic that I think is really unfair to place on students. So for me, it's like I found a place to like talk with the people that I loved, right? And the people that I care for and kind of help them kind of elevate, right? And I think that was a big part of it for me. And growing up, I grew up in Utah. This is another part I'll share. I don't know how much we want to get into this, but I grew up in Utah. So it was that's a state that's very divided by religion, by predominant religion. And that plays out in income as well. So I was on the wrong side of town, as it were, right? Quote unquote, the wrong side of town. Economically, socially, racially, like all these strange divisions that when I got to college, I went from seeing a very mixed community to seeing a very solidly white community, right? And that was jarring to me too. So again, it's like, I don't know that there is one thing. It was just like this weird coincidence of events that led to like understanding there's value in helping people learn this stuff.
Yeah, and it highlights, you know, the idea of also throwing in people being first generation onto all the topics that you already just mentioned, all the different identities and experiences of how those can be detrimental, or maybe that's not the word. Maybe it's more, they can be obstacles
trying to
move forward or find some of these, or even knowing the access is there. And so then we look at first generation students who may identify with a number of different things. And we look at the idea of intersectionality and how that then impacts people's education and access to it. And even once you're there, students are leaving four-year schools who are first generation and still haven't come to the understanding of all the different possible resources, or at least a bigger picture of the resources and things available to them while they're here. Because some of it is the experience of just, I'm here, I got to push through, I got to get this done. And there's so much happening, it's hard for students, whether first generation or not, sometimes to really be able to even look around and pan to the left or to the right and see what's there that's not so much in front of them. It was one message this last year, which was interesting, from a number of students were saying, hey, you know, everything was online. We were at home. And you know, the classes I learned the most from were the ones that pared it down and tried to give me a little bit less information than just here's all the material, go. So it begs the question of, is that something that could be beneficial in education period moving forward? Can we pare down some things so people can actually learn more as opposed to just get it all out there as the provider or the instructor and say, here's all the information. Oh, okay, we did our job. But students leave going, man, I don't know what I learned. I learned a third of what they wanted me to learn. In another class, they only gave me a third of what that one class gave me, but I learned all of it and I feel better about it. So it brings up a new conversation.
I think too, I want to say too, that I think folks are getting better at acknowledging like how much first generation students bring to the classroom already. Like they've been through such crazy experiences, right? And a lot of times they're economically based, they're social in terms of like divorce or alcoholism or all these kind of like heavier things that folks have to deal with. They're raising their own kids, they're raising other people's kids. I mean, whatever the issue is, right? And I think making a bridge between the challenge of those experiences and the real things that they do to their resilience, right, is such an underappreciated aspect of what they're experiencing, right? Because a lot of their peers who come from much more stable backgrounds are not confronted with these challenges. And so these students are in some ways twice or three times as prepared for the difficulties of what college asks for them, right? In a way that I really wish we gave more tribute to, you know?
For sure. It's speaks to, we've talked on the podcast a number of times about the different people doing different types of work around whether it's culturally sustaining pedagogy or culturally relative pedagogy or community cultural wealth or funds of knowledge. So all of these areas and looking at, you know, how these different types of capital can be used. And so it's always good to remind and go back, and we'll put some notes in the show notes to some of that literature and some of those topics again. So people can have that to go back and look at, because there are some great things. One of the ones I find is wonderful and fascinating all the time for me is the work that Christopher Emden's doing. And he's an educator, works predominantly and has over the years with Black male students, and does a lot of work around how do we take what we're learning in schools and bring in the context and make sure students can then see how do these things we're learning connect to our lives in everyday experiences. So he does a lot with science and math in that area too. So it's really cool. So, all right. So now that's some of your experiences, you know, both of you, thanks for sharing that. Now, I was saying before, one of the reasons I also wanted you to come to the podcast was you both have shared a little bit with me about this project you've done with oral first generation stories. And I had to say, well, that's about all I know about this project so far, except it sounds exciting. It sounds really cool. So let's have it on the podcast. Let's share. What is the project? Where is it at now? And what are your hopes and dreams moving forward with this?
Yeah. And Stephanie and I met ahead of time for this conversation. So we kind of divvied up this conversation. So I'll talk for a little bit, and then Stephanie will talk about some of the exciting things that she's come up with to do with this project. But so before I came to Chico State, I was at University of Northern Colorado, and I taught classes there to first generation students and to honor students at the same time that were all about research skills, right? Kind of like we do with the UNIV 101 classes here or some of the other student success courses that we have, like the TRIO class that we have here on campus. And so that's what I taught back there. And one of the things we wanted to do, like Stephanie mentioned earlier, was like introduce folks to kind of what libraries offer, like the kinds of resources they would encounter. And it was a big deal for me and my friend, Jay Trask, who's a university archivist at the University of Northern Colorado, to get students to really understand the archives, right? But if you've been to a university archive before, I think the first thing you recognize is whose story is being told, right? Like it's very removed, it's very antiquated feeling, it's very older, and it's very white, right? So it's the old white guy thing, right? That's who we see in the typical university history. And both Jay and I were really disappointed in that. So we tried with both classes a couple of different assignments to get students to kind of investigate the archives more. But it became really apparent that when students were confronted with this really expected history of, like, here's a cute beanie from 1920, or, you know, here's whatever archival piece it was, that there was nothing for them there. There was no space for them to be in that conversation, right? It was just like an artifact from 100 years ago that they really had no attachment to. So how could we fix that? And the thing that Jay and I came up with after a couple of trial and errors, we tried like show and tells with personal objects that students would bring and talk about to the class. We tried having them kind of curate these collections of personal belongings to tell other students about, but none of this was really working. And so I think we got to the point where we wanted to try something new. And what we really wanted was just to get the students to talk about themselves for a bit, right? We tried it with personal objects. They would bring in skateboards, photographs, belongings that meant a lot to them, shawls that were passed down in their family, that sort of thing. But we just weren't hearing them talk about themselves. So we thought, well, screw it. Let's just have them interview one another. Let's just have them, like, we don't want to overlay like this whole academic thing onto this conversation. We really want them to know at the heart of all of this, right, is that their being on this campus is the history of the campus, right? And that's what this whole project is about, whether it was back then or now with Stephanie, right? Like, the whole point is we want students to see and hear themselves and how much they matter to how this university defines itself, right? We are absolutely nothing without these students. And especially at Chico State, right, we're a predominantly non-Anglo campus now. We're a predominantly first-generation campus. And that really matters to how we think of our history 100 years from now, right? And this is where Stephanie's work is so valuable. So the goal of the project is that students essentially, we give them like one or two basic questions to ask them, ask one another. They record it however they want. We give them the opportunity to use the library equipment if they need it. They can use their cell phones, which is probably the most common way that they go about it. They ask each other a few common questions, and then they just talk about what it's like to be a student on the campus at that time. And since we're not moderating that conversation, we're not mediating that conversation. And really, the great thing about the archives is that the students retain the ownership of the conversation, right? So they can pull that when they want to. They can have it appear when they graduate. They can withdraw it after 5 years. It's really up to them, right? Like, their control over this, over who hears the conversation when. So if they don't want people to know what they said until 5 years after they graduated, it's great. And that turned into just this powerful, like, I'll give you some videos to share maybe in the podcast notes, but it just turned into a really amazing experience to watch the students have these conversations. So that is an ongoing assignment. We started that, I think, in 2015. We started doing that in Northern Colorado. It continues to this day. So they now have a 7-year archival history of first generation, first year students talking about what it's like to be on campus. And you'll hear conversations about dating, about their families, about race on the campus, about being missold an experience through marketing that they didn't see in reality. All the things I think we hear about at Chico State, right? So that's, I don't know, Stephanie, you tell me, is that enough of a basis for the assignment? Does that kind of get at it?
I think so. Do you want to share a little bit about bringing it here and how that a misfire or a misfire?
How it bombed, yeah. So Stephanie and I, like, Stephanie, as soon as I shared this past experience with her, she was like 100% on board, because this is her realm, right? And so we were involved in the faculty and staff first gen group at that time on campus. And they had the symposium. I think it was the first year of the symposium that we tried to really do it. And the downside, there were a couple of downsides. I mean, we certainly wanted people to be aware of the possibilities of the university archives, because I think Chico State hasn't really like tapped into how deep these archives can go in terms of capturing student histories or personal histories. So we tried it at the first gen symposium, and we got a couple of folks who did it, but it was mostly like, and Stephanie said this earlier, so I'm gonna steal her words, but it was mostly like folks who had gotten very comfortable telling their first gen stories, right? Like folks who kind of on campus were reliable sources of the first gen story. And that wasn't, you know, it got away from the student part of it. I think that was so important to us to really capture. So we tried it at the symposium. It didn't really take off. And then it kind of fell flat for a little bit. Like, we didn't know what to do with it. But
yeah, I got to say, I don't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry. One of the things that I think is really powerful about the videos that William has linked in this episode is the dialogue, the bouncing of energy off of two, one person with another, right? And that was something that was really missing from the interviews or really monologues that we got at the First Gen Symposium. We were hearing from folks who were very comfortable speaking, who were very confident in themselves and their story, and therefore had, you know, like you said, a sort of a rehearsed kind of approach to telling their story. And that was less dynamic and exciting than we were hoping for. And so I wouldn't say it bombed so much as it gave us an opportunity to kind of recalibrate, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, I agree completely. And then I think we were approached by an individual at a different university, University of Nebraska, I think it was, who was really curious about the project from Colorado. So Stephanie and I, and then the folks at Colorado who were still involved with that project there, we all got together, wrote a big thing up, and that seemed to get some additional attention from NASPA, I believe the name of the organization is. Thank you. So the thing has kind of picked up like new legs, right? So we're super excited because we also have the new institutional repository in place, which is CSU-wide archive. So we've got the place to hold these stories. So we've got the assignment, right, from past years that's been updated for now. We've got the place to store these student stories. We know better what we're trying to get at. I think I know better what I'm trying to get at, I should say. So we're ready to go nuts, right?
So it's interesting because alongside this podcast that we're doing with you, Joshua, William and I have also signed up to present this project, what we're really calling a classroom activity, right? It's an assignment for students, for professors to bring into their classroom and allow their first year students or their students of color or any students who are analyzing rhetoric, right, to take the assignment and put it into their class and then allow us at the University Archives to capture those interviews. So this is something that we're going to be discussing a little bit more in detail with the faculty development teaching racial and social justice series that I'm really excited will be coming out in a few weeks.
Yep, that's great. That's a good series. It's been in effect now for about, I think, one full year. This is the second year of that, so that's great. I think we've had one. Yours is coming up in the spring semester.
I'm hoping it will November. Be in the next few weeks.
Oh, it's in November, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's so fresh.
This episode may come out right when that one comes out too. Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
We're doing as much as we can to promote it because I think you're right. It has picked up legs and really, you know, this is one of the things that I noticed when I was in my undergraduate experience, you know, being in Native American studies, having like ethnic studies courses, and then coming into the university archives and seeing that a lot, like William said, a lot of what is already held in the university archives is the history of, you know, land owning, cisgendered, heteronormative men, you know, and that's not reflective of our current students' lived experiences. And so we really need to do what is our role, as that quote said, you know, we have to be, I don't know if aggressive is the word that they use, not to be passive.
Radical,
right?
Radical positive change agent.
Yeah, we can't be aggressive about it. We do want to just do our part to reach out. That's the goal. We want folks, students and faculty specifically, to know that we have an interest and a desire in diversifying the history of the campus because it is diverse right now.
Absolutely. And the thing I love is that we're capturing people at the point of life when they're confronting like so many interesting decisions about themselves, about the things, the choices that they're making about their future, about their friendships. I mean, we all remember being 18, 19, 20. It's horrible. It's horribly dramatic, right? You make really big decisions that you don't realize the impact of until years later. And so to capture students, and one of the things I admire about students now is that they seem so much, much more present in their heads than I ever felt as a student, right? And so I envy them like crazy. But just to capture that, that kind of point of life where they're doing this thing, I love it. I love it so much. And it's like Stephanie said, like the energy is just not what we are seeing with other folks. And it's just a beautiful thing when you watch, yeah, just folks talking about themselves. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and I think a lot of my research and interviews and focus groups is often with first generation students as well. We're always talking about music and the impact it has on them and how they utilize music. And it's the same thing. They are just open, free, and it's not so much even decisions they're making. A lot of it, we are realizing it's discoveries they're making that they didn't even realize were part of who they were necessarily until they start talking about it in a different way for them. So I can't wait to see some of these videos.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that what's interesting is that this reminds me of the way that research is the most beneficial, which is you're taking new information and you're integrating it into your known experience, right? And that's the best way to retain that new information. And when we make materials that are reflective of somebody's personal experience, then, you know, we're just helping them to achieve a better integration into what it means to be at Chico State, what it means to be pursuing higher education, what it means to be a critical thinker, you know, not necessarily a wildcat, but somebody who's thinking critically about their academic experience, right? So I'm really keen on education functioning as, you know, a practice of being reflective on where you're at in the world and where you want to be and what are the barriers to helping you transform the world you're in into the world you want. And I think the only way we're going to do that is if we empower these students to see themselves as scholars.
And that's one thing that's been the message and part of our mission to keep creating awareness and providing resources for, like I said, faculty, staff, and other students who are working with and collaborating alongside first-generation students, because our latest numbers we can look at, you know, between 50 to 60% of our students are first-generation, those who report, you know, that. And so we have a lot here, obviously, as William pointed out earlier. It's the largest student group on campus, you know, if you look at any one student group. And so then more people are starting, like you said, to hear. And the message for us is to get it out so people can say, okay, how am I working with first generation students? Oh, that might help explain why so many people in my class have this similar reaction to a project or to something in class, or, you know, so more and more people are hopefully hearing about it and getting themselves to a place to be comfortable doing some of these things or asking some of these questions. But it then raises that up like, oh, that's part of our job to help a lot of these students who don't have a resource back home. So it becomes this sort of thing that people were doing for years, only who were part of affinity groups. If you're a part of EOP or you're part of TRIO or these groups that were focused on first generation, and then all of a sudden working in those areas, and I did that for the 20 years before moving to a new place now, was all of a sudden we were talking and saying, hey, we can only help so many people. Now we see there's twice as many first generation students here than we can take into our program. Oh, now there's three times. Now there's four times. And then it got to almost 10 times what EOP could work with and what TRIO can do. And so we see different things popping up, but it is part of this hidden part of our job now as educators of how do we help first generation students see themselves in a light that when they go home, they don't necessarily get the same messages or the same role modeling, because people at home answer them honestly and say, hey, I wish I could help you more. I wish I could be there for you more. I don't know what it means to do these things or what your next step would be, or even how do you go about doing research if it's on that level, not to mention the career level or the moving on to graduate school decisions and things like that. So it's a new job.
and I, from the, you know, from the institutional perspective too, one of the things I really hope comes out of this growth in this population, right, is that the university starts to see itself as a first generation college, right? We're a first generation university. And I think that even just changing that perspective can kind of help shift our minds to, like, it's, you know, it's not fitting folks, like you say, like fitting folks into a certain program until it's at capacity. It's like understanding that this is the whole campus now, right? Like, this is us. And so of course everything should be geared. Like, there's a lot of conversations about how things are worded to make sure we're not over academifying language needlessly, to make sure website language is clear, to make sure that there's a great thing out of University of Las Vegas called the task purpose criteria way to write assignments, where you're being very, very deliberate in asking students what they're doing, how to succeed at it, and what the point is. Right, just being really, really transparent in how you write assignments for students, and so that's modeled in this assignment as well. But really making sure that we are talking to the students who are here, right? To making sure we're not putting any barriers in places where we wouldn't expect to have barriers, like on the website or any of that. Yeah, I think that's an important part for us.
It is. There's this very many factors to consider, to weigh, how to go about it, and some people who are newly excited and newly wanting to, and some people are new and just sort of like, I never thought about helping first gen students, or I don't know about it. No matter where their entry point is, quite often a lot of response I get from people is, wow, this is a lot. There's so much more than I ever imagined of them just being the first person going to school. And unfortunately with that, talking about school and teaching and all these things, I have to remember that I need to go teach class in 19 minutes. So, unfortunately, we have run out of time. The social construct, is it really a thing? I don't know, but we do have these time frames we do live by nowadays. I used to love the feeling of not having time in my life, and just every day was one day, and the whole life was one day, and just do things. And then I got older and.
Before I want to respect your class, but I also want to respect Stephanie, because she has some great ideas about where this project and connected projects can go. Do you want to, like, throw that in, Stephanie, or are you going to make him edit this whole thing out? You're going to do that.
No, I'm not going to edit it all out.
I think what I need to do, for me, my perspective is I really do want to be very strategic and intentional about how we grow this. I was having a great conversation with a colleague just a few days ago, and they were talking about not being in crisis mode all the time. Yeah. And so I really respect that approach, and I'm trying to think about myself and how I operate and wanting to be strategic and really trying to focus on building relationships, you know, that building, you know, interdisciplinary relationships between the university archives or the library and, you know, TLP or the Star Center or, you know, Path Scholars or, you know, Student Life and Leadership. All of these things are super important to me to be excellent at maintaining a commitment to being, to diversifying the university archives. And so if I can continue to do that and be known for that, then that is all I want. You know, I just want people to know that they can reach out, and we want it. We want those materials in the university archives. But I also want to be very strategic and careful about it's not blasting that to the world, because I think time is a construct. And also space is a construct, right? Like, we have very limited space, and the funding that the library gets is limited as well, right? And so I don't want to oversell what we can do based on the limitations of please edit all of this out.
I don't think we did any of this. It's perfect.
I was going to say, like, it's addicting. Once you start hearing, like, the sincerity of these stories of people just talking to one another, it's addicting. You want to hear everybody talk about themselves. Like, I don't know. I find it's the only time I ever want to hear people talking about themselves is in these recordings.
Right. But I'll say just the last part of this, we're not going to edit any of this out. I think it's wonderful, because it really does help to show exactly the forethought, the insight, the intentionality and focus that the library is bringing into projects and that you all have. It's not just like, hey, we thought of something cool. Here you go. Let's make it happen. You're really considering other people. And that's one of the big messages at the beginning of COVID that people started saying, hey, we need to be great. We need to have grace. We need to be patient with other people. We need to be considerate and compassionate. And so now that it's a different phase of COVID and some people are on campus, some people aren't. Some programs are doing things different ways that they never used to do before. And some are doing it with open arms. Some are doing it like, oh, if we don't do it, we have to do it. So, but there's all these different entry points and different ways of going about it that sometimes the discussion around being compassionate and patient has also left the building because people are back and some people are like, hey, we're just back to going full bore. Let's do it. And it's like, wait, whoa, let's learn from what we did. And let's make sure we're not overwhelming any colleagues or ourselves and let's do things. So you've heard it here first. This project is going to roll out somewhere on a freight train near you at a speed that is, you know, hopefully not too much. And you'll be able to jump on board when you're ready for it, because it sounds like an amazing project to see. And there will be, like I said, there will be links in the show notes to watch some of these videos and hear about it and see what's there. So with that being said, we're into our recommendations. All right, William, what do you have for us today?
Gosh, it is October and it was just Indigenous Peoples Day. And I am currently reading a really fantastic horror novel by Stephen Graham Jones, who's a Blackfeet author. It is called My Heart is a Chainsaw. And it is about a young woman who is so versed. She's like this goth woman. She's Indigenous. And she is obsessed with horror films. And then these weird occurrences start happening in the community where she lives. And it's a brilliant, brilliant, really fun book so far.
All right. It sounds like it. Those are always fun horror books to read. Those are always entertaining, right? Now, and William, you were going to throw out one thing. I guess I'll just say it since I'm here now, is Kurzweil 3000.
Oh, yeah.
Text to audio program, and it'll be in the show notes. If you're a Chico State student, you have access to it. If you are not, the campus you attend may have it. Ask your librarian about it on your campus. Ask your IT office about it, but you may have it. Ask your accessibility office possibly. And if you have it, they'll let you know how to get to it. If you don't, there is a web application you can go to. It's Kurzweil 3000, and that link will be in the show note as well. All right, Stephanie, what do you have?
Hi, yeah, I want to share about a book that I feel really closely connected to. It's called Emergent Strategy, and I believe the subtitle is Shaping Change, Changing Worlds. And it's a nonfiction book, but it is written by a woman named Adrienne Marie Brown, who has based her approach, it's sort of like a way of being or like a model for changing your environment to, it's based on the writings of Octavia Butler, who is a science fiction writer. And they are both Black women, and it is so awesome to see how Octavia Butler's science fiction and Afrofuturist writing can still have applications for living in 2021, you know, even though she passed away sometime in the 90s. And so, yeah, Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change, Changing Worlds is my recommendation. Check it out.
Okay, great. Thank you. Books are always good to hear about, especially from librarians. And so I have two, and I often say, hey, let's do recommendations when you're doing them. Get ready. They don't have to be about the topic today. They can be about whatever. So you two did that. But of course, I went with two that happened to be more about today's topic somehow. So one of the sites that I love going to is the National Archives website. And so it's a place where you can then drill down and find, like Stephanie mentioned, primary, secondary, tertiary. So you can find a lot of primary sources from over 150 or 200 years ago of documents there. That's a great website, National Archives. So that'll be in our show notes, the link. And the other one, when I was in school doing some classes, one of the classes I found to be fascinating was the judicial law in higher education. And I was one of the more fascinating classes, but one of the things you can do, I had never done before that time, is you can go to the Supreme Court website, oral arguments, and you can actually find all of the audio and the transcripts of all the way, you know, from over 100 years ago, you can find them, the recordings. Yep. So you can also use OYEZ, which I'll put on to there. It's a different link, but OYEZ is also another site where you can find them. Anyway, it's fascinating. You can hear them actually having their arguments, why they have the decision they made. And you can go back if you're interested in education. You can look at Brown versus Board of Education if you'd like to look at free speech issues. You can find, you can search by topics. So you can just go through what is the history of free speech decisions the Supreme Court's made and why they're in place. And it's kind of, it was interesting. So I had to at one point like turn off that website and walk away because I ended up spending, you know, too much time each day listening to these things. So anyway, it's a great resource. So they'll both be there. And those are our recommendations for the day. So again, thank you, William. And thank you, Stephanie, for being here, being gracious to join me.
Thank you.
I look forward to our future endeavors and seeing you around the library.
Thanks so much.
Awesome. This was great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listeners, hope you can turn in next time when we have another fun episode on first generation discussions.
Bye.
Bye.